Set for the oral argument in case number 71044, Cameron Thomas versus State. We have Mr. Orem and Ms. Renetti for the, we have Mr. Orem for the appellant, Ms. Renetti for the respondent. I'm the Associate Chief Justice Michael Cherry. I'm the presiding justice of the Southern panel. With me is Justice Lydia Stiglich on my left and Justice Ron Perigary on my right. This oral argument is 60 minutes. I was Chief Justice when this case came before us in 17, and I granted a motion for extended word limit by about 11,000 words. So I figured 60 minutes was well worth it, and I think it's good. I mentioned that to my colleague Justice Stiglitz, that sometimes giving you more time, you don't have to rush through. I think you have about 14 issues in this case, so. Your time. You got 60 to 30 each. You want to reserve some time on this run?
Your Honor, could I reserve 10 minutes,
please? Sure. We'll try to watch it for you. Go ahead and cover as many of these issues as you can, please. And Ms. Renetti, you'll respond to those issues.
May it please the Court. My name is Christopher Orem. I represent Mr. Thomas. Mr. Thomas's trial was grossly unfair. It was grossly unfair for multiple reasons. I would argue that several of the reasons I'm going through, just in and of themselves, should reverse this case. I'll start off with the basic one, and that is one of the sort of the themes of the case that was most disturbing, and that is that in Nevada versus Jackson, the United States Supreme Court considered one of our state's cases and determined that they were concerned that the defendant wasn't able to put on the proper defense. In that case, the defendant's girlfriend or ex-girlfriend had written a letter saying that she was recanting her statement. They would not let in reports, but they let proper cross-examination of the girlfriend. The U.S. Supreme Court said that that was acceptable because there was proper cross-examination. Let's look at this case. What happens here from the very starting point? What's the truth? And the truth is very different than what happened at trial. The truth is ZF, I believe 9 years old at the time, was brought into the principal's office because they're investigating her mother, April, beating her with an electrical cord. The state doesn't dispute that. I couldn't get the records on this. But they agreed that there was substantial, that it was substantiated that April was beating the child. Officer Sink was on his way to the principal's office for the purpose of this investigation of child abuse. So what we know is that this little child was being beaten by her mother. That's not what the jury heard. The jury doesn't know any of that. What the jury heard was that ZF made a spontaneous statement to the principal saying, Cameron Thomas is molesting me. They then sent police to investigate, which seems proper, doesn't it? If a child has revealed something like this, police should become involved. That's what the state of the evidence was. This was bitterly objected to by trial counsel. And when I quote Nevada versus Jackson, I also cited several other U.S. Supreme Court cases, California versus Trombetta, where they cite, U.S. Supreme Court says, a meaningful opportunity to present a complete defense. That's what they were worried about. In U.S. versus Van Zula Bernal, the U.S. Supreme Court said, we call this area an area of constitutional guaranteed access to evidence. Why on earth was this kept out of this case? I want to fast forward to show you how unfair it really was. The prosecutor, in closing arguments, began to mock the defense because the defense was left with, well, there was a lawsuit. Maybe that's why the children are saying this. And so the prosecutor was then able to seize on this and just mock the defense. Let me read to you from pages, some of these quotes are coming from pages 23 to 29 of my opening brief, which also becomes important in and of itself. The prosecutor stated, August 2010, Kay and April visit Vegas. Again, no bad feelings. This is a prior to the disclosure of ZF. This is all months prior to ZF's disclosure. So everyone's in a good place at this time. There is no revenge. at this time. There's no animosity or ill will. Well, when I see that everyone's in a good place at that time, that means ZF went in there, normal child, saying, I was molested. A good place? She's being beaten by her mother. Can you imagine saying that argument as a prosecutor to the jury if the jury had known that April was beating her child? The kids are in a good place? They're being beaten by their mother. How can you possibly say this? Well, you can say this because the court has kept this information out and the prosecutor's seizing on it. Is that the only quote? Maybe they could define why they said that. Let's go to the next one. On page 24, the prosecutor explained, there's no evidence. There is no evidence in this case that there were any fights, any disagreements, any unresolved issues on December 9, 2010. Think of that in context to the child who was being interviewed because her mother was beating her. There were no disagreements. Any unresolved issues? None? What do you mean there are no unresolved issues? The child is being questioned about the beating by her mother. How can the prosecutor get away with this? More importantly, how can the judge let that happen?
Well, what was the judge's
explanation for keeping this out?
The judge said, I don't want the state to have to defend a child abuse claim by April. That's what she said.
Well, she kind of said it was irrelevant, didn't she?
Yes.
And that was her basis?
Yeah, irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant, and then the prosecutor is saying these things. This is completely false. So let's assume that's accurate. Let's assume that that's what the court thought. It's irrelevant. Once the prosecutor makes these statements in closing argument, isn't that a problem? Wait a second. I kept that out as irrelevant. You're now seizing on it, and what you're saying is an opposite to the truth of the matter in this case.
Did trial counsel make a record on that?
Yes. Objections to all of these things. Bitter objections to this. Bitter objections. It continued.
Mr. Orem, didn't ZF confirm to the investigator the allegations against the mother? So when asked about whether or not mom's beating the child, ZF confirmed that was true, correct?
I don't know the answer to that because I motioned the court to receive the CPS records, and I was not able to get those, and trial counsel was not able to get those, so I don't want to say something that I think could be inaccurate. I don't remember ZF saying that. I know that the state conceded that in the briefs. They conceded and conceded below that it was substantiated, that April was beating the child. So then it gets worse. I think, Justice Perry-Gary, if the judge finds it's irrelevant, then when the prosecutor says in closing arguments, I submit to you there's not one piece of evidence in this case to impute the motives and suggest motives. Then the prosecutor says, what is this mother, vile? Is that what Mr. Mann is saying, that the mother is vile? It's actually mocking. Can you imagine if the jury knew the truth? The jury would be like, yes, she's vile. She absolutely beat her child with an electrical cord. Yet because that was kept out, the prosecution was able to say, hey, what is this, a vile mother? Because they knew that the jury would think, the mother's doing nothing wrong. The mother's a good mom. She's done absolutely nothing wrong. Because there was no evidence in the record that she was anything other than a really good mother.
But what if the evidence had come in that, yes, mother's vile, to take your words, the child confirms the activity. So what's the relevance?
The relevance is because Cameron Thomas was known by the accusers, identity was not an issue. So he couldn't say, oh, they're accusing another Cameron Thomas. The only defense is the children are manufacturing this story.
Okay, so how does that confirmation of that conduct by the child tend to show fabrication by ZF?
It deflects. It's immediate deflection. Immediate deflection. In other words, my mother is being investigated. I'm scared of my mother. So your mother's beating you? Yes, but don't worry. I'm being molested by Cameron Thomas. Oh, let's get on that. So it's deflection. And what I wrote in the brief that I think is interesting is that to the three justices I argued before today, maybe if you read this entire case and you looked at that, I don't think that defense would work. I don't think it works. That's not the point. The point is that's the theory of defense. It's not whether the court would acquit him. It's not whether the district court would acquit him or whether the prosecutors agree. It's a defense. I could make that argument to a jury in a compelling way. to see the children were scared. They were scared of the mom. What's the obvious thing to do? Once they know their mother's being investigated, they deflect. Get off my mother and get on to Cameron Thomas. What else do we know about ZF? ZF knew and AP knew from their mother that they had had a fight with Cameron Thomas, that Cameron Thomas had loaned them money, they hadn't paid it back, and they told those children, you don't talk to Cameron Thompson. So those children knew that the mom and April and Kay, their partners, they knew that they were unhappy with Cameron Thomas. So it makes logical sense that I could make that compelling argument. And again, it's not a defense in a criminal trial. I would never stop in a closing argument and say, hey, Judge, do you agree with me? Because I think probably 90% of the time, the judge is like, you're in trouble, okay? And that's just the nature of our adversarial system. But you can't take away the ability to defend. And that's what the judge did. And I'll tell you, it got much more difficult for the judge. Because the judge at one point, there was a quote from the judge the judge says on page 43 of my brief in a footnote, and I thought it was great, the police officer's coming in to testify. And the judge is this outside the presence of the jury. You know what? I don't know how to get out of the context when you get called to the principal's office. She couldn't figure out how they're going to put the police officer on to explain all this because you've got to change the whole truth. You have to change the whole truth. This became a spontaneous statement by ZF. And now a police officer is going to say, well, I was responding because the mother was beating the child. Oh, yeah, but we've got to change this so that this has to look spontaneous. And that's what happened. In other words, the jury would have believed that ZF just came in there and said, I'm being molested. And that's a horrible thing. And the prosecutor then, and by the way, the word vile was used by the prosecutor continuously in the closing argument. I only use that in cite to the record for that. But the prosecutor said, further said, there's no motivation for the kids to do this. And then the prosecutor says, maybe that was genesis for April, this vile human being, to have her children make this story up. The prosecutor further says, there was no master plan. It makes no sense. Mr. Mann points to April. She has to be this vile woman to do this right. This is just terrible. It's terrible to let facts, to be a defendant and sit there and go, she is vile. She beat her child and they're mocking me. Even when the defendant was on the stand, he referred to her as an unfit mother. He was talking about a discussion that had occurred. And when they asked why was she unfit, he was precluded from saying, I know what she's done. He's not even allowed to say that. And I want to complain, too.
Let me ask you this, though. In understanding how we review these cases, it's a little difficult because we don't have the order and we don't have the transcript. There's just the allegations in the briefs as to what happened. And so we basically got a journal entry by the judge stating the state's motion is granted, and that's it. Where in the record do we find this other than statements that are contained in the briefs? That's just a concern that I've got.
Well, I was very careful about my cites, and I have cited very carefully to every portion, everything I've just cited to, I cited where in the record it came from, where in the trial it came from. And so I wanted to go, I had left this for last, but I really want to mention it.
But Mr. Orr, it's very difficult to rely on court minutes for these type of principles, I guess. I don't understand why we don't have the orders and we don't have those other pieces to this. I recognize you've supported your cites by what is in the appendix, but why aren't those things in the appendix?
I didn't see, the only time I ever saw an objection by the state, they objected to one particular transcript not being present. We then supplied that in the reply brief.
But I'm not talking about what they want or don't want. I'm talking about what you put in to support your asks. So why don't we have those?
Honestly, as I stand here, I'm not sure what it is the court would be missing. I think that from what I can see, the record is complete on these issues. I did not see, and I would have observed if the state had said there was something missing, but they did not quarrel with any of my quotes. And so have I answered your question?
Yes.
How did the judge handle the police officer coming to the school? How did it happen?
They just sanitized everything. It just became.
But how? Tell me what happened.
The officer came in and said, "I talked to the young lady, and It came in under 51, the statute of hearsay exception, and they just sanitized it, made it sound like the child was complaining. The child's complaining about being molested, so obviously police officers come. So the police officers came.
Well, I want to ask, because I'm going to ask Ms. Rinetti as well, under 51385, do you think that police interrogations are the type of statements that are, well, spontaneous statements in the first instance are the type of statements that are meant to be captured by 51385?
No, I don't. I don't think a lot of those statements should have come in. You may notice that the district court every single time granted them, every single time let them come in. And so I did not understand how they were spontaneous. And the court has given us five considerations in Jefferson versus Nevada, which is 2014. Three of the five I thought were very relevant to this case. One, the statement is supposed to be spontaneous. Well, the jury would have said it was spontaneous, but now we know it's not, because it wasn't spontaneous. Second, is there motive to fabricate? Yes, there's motive to fabricate. Let's deflect away from my mother getting in serious trouble. And three, the third factor is, was the child's mental state stable? Well, in this case, ZF admitted, I'm lying all the time. That's what you actually testified to. I lie all the time. I lie and I steal. So, and my mother's beating me. She didn't say that, but we know that. So how is that, how are those reliable under Jefferson versus Nevada? And so under 51.385, I would argue that they didn't meet those three factors. And furthermore, the district court let in other witnesses under that statute where Mr. Cameron Thomas was acquitted. So it clearly wasn't reliable. But I also wrote in the brief, with regard to reliability, when defense counsel is able to say, hey, ZF's an admitted liar, an admitted thief, lies all the time, what would we need to show that the child wasn't reliable? I thought that was a better question. Would I need a perjury conviction on a 9-year-old? What would I show if I can say to a judge, this person admits she lies all the time? Doesn't that question reliability? Isn't that go to sufficiency? And I thought, well, the district court got to see her testify for a few hours. Now the district court can make a determination that this person is sufficient given the statements they've made. So under that issue, which was number three, I thought that they had not been able to do that, and it should not have come in. I did want to complain about some things about this appeal. I was asked about why I did not include things. In this reply, or this state's response, I recognize that Ms. Rinetti did not write this, but there are three things that I think were improper in front of this court. First, the state claimed that I had said on appeal that the defense was not able to even present that ZF was scared of their mother, making it look like, hey, I hadn't even cited correctly. I then, in my reply, said, well, read my opening brief more carefully, because I specifically said in the opening brief the only thing that trial counsel was able to bring out was ZF and AP were frightened of their mother. They were able to bring it up. And I put that in there. I don't know why they're telling the court something that's completely inaccurate. Was it just a one-time thing? They also said, the arguments you've just heard me talk about, the prosecutor's 12 statements from pages 23 through 29, six pages of cites. And I want to tell you, once I had the prosecution saying that, I put in the end of my opening brief, or not right after that, right after I cited the 12 statements, I said, undoubtedly, in the state's response, they will argue I've taken this out of context. I've done this a little while, and I knew that the state would be forced to say that he's taking it out of context. No. They didn't mention these 12 statements. Not one of them. Not one of them was brought before you. In fact, they only say one line, and I've got a quote for you. As to the state's closing, defendant's assertions are belied by the record. That's what they gave you. When I read to you those comments the prosecutor made, and that's what they respond to, how do they even let me do a reply? How do I get to reply to it's belied by the record? No, it's not. I cited to it. It's not belied by the record. You just caught and don't know what to say. The third thing I want to complain about is they said, and I'll get to the civil suit issue, they said that the defense wanted the settlement in, that the defense wanted the lawsuit in. That's not true. And interestingly enough, they don't cite to the record on this at all. This is not...
Well, you know, and maybe I misread it, but my understanding was it was one of the defense exhibits, And when questioned about it, they said, well, we may or may not use it, but doesn't that go back to your point that the civil lawsuit was indicative of a motive to fabricate because they had a financial incentive?
Two things. I would disagree with the characterization the defense wanted to do so. Right before opening argument, the prosecution brought up the civil lawsuit. And defense counsel said, I may use the fact that they filed the lawsuit, but I will not use settlement. And then the judge says this wonderful quote. The judge says, well, if he opens the door, meaning defense counsel, then we will see what we're going to do from there. State got up in opening argument and proceeded to say, they filed the lawsuit, they settled, here are the amounts of money. The amounts of money were $32,000, $31,000, $50,000. And they did it, and as I pointed out in the opening brief, by the time they were questioning witnesses, the defense hadn't said a word about it. Not one word. So at some point, what was the defense attorney supposed to do?
How did that hurt you?
Well, under the two cases, rather than me say it, the Seventh Circuit and Second Circuit have both complained that you can't bring in a settlement because, as I end my argument with, nothing could be more prejudicial to a fair trial, and I'm citing to U.S. versus Konovowski from the Seventh Circuit. Nothing could be more damaging.
Did you object?
Counsel objected. To it coming in, said, I'm not sure it's going to be used, and was told it if you open the door.
So when the state used it in their opening statement, did you object? Or you? I say you. Did counsel object?
No, please. So. Okay. I see my time is...
Yeah,
is
I was going to say
you got 9:25 left.
Thanks.
Ms. Renetti. For the state.
Good morning to this court. My name is Dina Renetti, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada, if it please the court, as well as counsel. Mr. Oram's argument that the defense was thwarted in their theory of defense is belied by the record. And I quote from the opening statement of the defense. This case is about revenge. It's about money. It's about manipulation. And it's about character. All of those theories were addressed significantly throughout this three-week trial. The theory of defense that ZF's physical abuse is somehow relevant is absolutely untrue. I understand that the defense is entitled to their theory, but they also must abide by the rules of evidence. Was Zaley's physical abuse, as both Justice Perigary and Justice Stiglitz pointed out, was it relevant? And it absolutely was not relevant.
Why not?
And this is why. Because in Appellant Appendix 470 through 476 was some of the briefs that the trial court relied upon in ruling on this issue of whether this evidence was, in fact, relevant. Whether ZF was deflecting away attention from her mother's abuse by accusing the defendant, Cameron Thomas. In fact, what was litigated down in trial court was ZF went to the principal because there was one loop mark on her arm. When questioned, and that was provided to the trial court, ZF volunteered, in fact, she had other injuries on her body that the staff at the school could not see. She had injuries to her leg from other whip marks. And in fact, the school nurse went back and had her take her pants off and took photographs. Moreover, ZF, during that consultation with school staff, said, guess what? There are other times my mom has whipped me with a cord. And then when further and said, there are instances where my mother slaps me with an open hand. So that's what the trial court relied upon, and whether or not this child, when making this disclosure, was deflecting attention away from her mother's physical abuse. And the answer is absolutely not. By the records that were provided and the arguments that were made by the state in its motion as well as its reply, and again, that's Appellate Appendix 470 through 476.
Is that you're basically saying that undermines the argument that, what you're saying is it shows she wasn't afraid of her mother to the extent that she would try and deflect somewhere else, because she clearly indicated everything her mother had done to her.
Correct. She was not deflecting. Now, I won't say that, that ZF wasn't afraid of her mother. It came out in the trial.
That's what I thought Mr. Orms said, that ZF and AP was frightened of their mother.
Absolutely. It came out first in cross-examination of ZF. Defense counsel asked Zaylee a series of questions regarding, you get in trouble a lot, don't you? And Zaylee said, I do. And when you get in trouble, your mom gets angry. And Zaylee said in the affirmative, yes, my mom gets angry. And when your mom gets angry, you're scared of your mother. And she said, absolutely. So there's the defense. What added benefit do you get from the physical abuse? It's the fact of the matter is that the child's scared of her mother. That theory of defense was presented throughout this trial, both from ZF as well as her sister, AF. And so I believe when the trial court was confronted with this information, there was really this evidence was absolutely irrelevant to the theory of case because it was belied by the facts of the Arizona police report. In fact, most of the abuse wouldn't have been uncovered but for ZF's disclosures to school authorities as well as to police. Mr. Orr makes quite a lot of comments regarding the state's closing arguments in regards to that the family was in a good place. But remember what the trial for 3 weeks was all about. That there was animosity between these two families. That there was this hatred, for lack of a better word, between April and Kay and the defendant and his family. That there were allegations that Cameron Thomas had called April an unfit mother, and that enraged April, and then she told her children that she couldn't speak to the defendant and his family. There's also allegations regarding the car loan, and that was the impetus of a fairly large rift between the two families, that the defendant's family was kind enough to loan this family money, and then things went haywire. That's what we were talking about in closing arguments. It was the evidence that the defense presented, and they presented quite a defense. They called multiple character witnesses in this particular case, former employers, family members, all to talk about this rift between the families. And that is what the state's closing argument was about. And I understand Mr. Orham's argument that we should have briefed it more extensively in the briefs, but at the end of the day, I understand that this court has the record, has a trial transcript, and if you read the closing arguments in its entirety, what the state was trying to do was to rebut the defense's opening remarks that this case is about revenge, and it's about manipulation, and it's about money. And that's exactly what we did with our comments in closing argument. I also wanted to address the civil suit. And Justice Peregrine, you're absolutely correct. It was that settlement order was marked as a defense exhibit. We were provided a copy of it during discovery. Throughout the pretrial litigation, defense counsel had mentioned this motivation about money. And so it was obviously something that the state was aware that the defense would be getting into. And
let
so
me
I
ask
know,
you this, though. Yes. With the ruling, as I understand it, that determination wasn't going to be made until the defense opened the door, as Mr. Norm said. And so how do you get there if you didn't make a motion in limine to have it admitted?
And I quote from the appellate appendix 1588, and what the trial counsel said, I will definitely ask the parties about, hey, you guys filed a lawsuit. You can't use it as a sword and a shield, this information.
That's a whole different thing. The settlement, admitting the settlement and testimony that, a lawsuit was filed. My understanding was, pertaining to the settlement itself and revealing that information, wasn't going to happen until the defense opened the door.
What's the Nevada case that says you can admit settlements? What's the case?
There is none, Justice, and I absolutely agree. And what I will say to you...
It's not admissible. Correct. I mean, I've been on been here for 48 years. I've never seen settlements admitted into criminal cases.
And this is what I will say, Your Honor.
It's error. Are you confessing that that's error?
That is error. I will say that there is no case law that permits me to do that. But here are the things that I would say. What I would say, I believe the defense had made it very known that they're going into the file to the civil suit. Right. No one argued at the trial level that because this case was somehow settled, that somehow impugned responsibility or liability to the defendant. And in fact, the defense called the owner of the daycare, it was Bonnie Hart, during the their case in chief. And in that, she was allowed to testify that as a character witness and essentially said it was not her decision to settle the lawsuit. In fact, it was just the insurance company, and then went on to say what a great employee Cameron Thomas was and that he was well-liked by not only the staff, but parents and the children at that daycare. So I do believe that there was no prejudice regarding that because neither side, especially the state, never argued that the settlement somehow impugned liability to this defendant. What was the concern of the state is, obviously, Mr. Oram read some of the numbers off regarding the settlement. And what was painted in the trial in this case was that April and Kay were basically almost destitute. Month to month, they couldn't even pay their rent. That car loans had to be taken out just to make ends meet. That Cameron Thomas's family had to come to the aid of this family in order for this family to survive. And so it was defense counsel and his strategy to bring up the amount of money to show, oh my goodness, although this may not be a lot of money to some people, for April and Kay, this is not just a lifeline. I mean, this is hitting the lottery for this basically destitute family who was actually moving in with the defendant's family at one point because they couldn't pay the rent. And so I think it absolutely did not affect or prejudice this defendant in any way.
Who actually brought in the money? Like,
it was the defense counsel.
Sometimes these things are just order of proof. Like, I appreciate that we know they're going to do that. In fact, you know they're gonna attack its credibility. But you agree, the state can't bolster its witnesses' credibility or rebut those things until they come up. I mean, some of it's order of proof. Some of it is the state probably should have properly waited until the defense talked about the civil suit to come back and bang him back. You agree with that or no?
I disagree in one sense, mm-hmm. Justice. Is right before opening statements, defense counsel said, yes, definitively, I'm going into the civil suit. So I think it's patently unfair for the state to get up there and not address in an opening statement as far as the roadmap of what this case is about, and then let defense counsel get up there and say, you know what the state didn't tell you? The state didn't tell you that this family filed a civil suit. This family that had to sleep on Cameron Thomas's couch, that had to take out car loans, that wasn't able to pay their monthly bills, guess what? They filed a lawsuit, and then the floodgates opened, and then the other two named victims, once the news report came out, jumped on that bandwagon. It's patently unfair for the state to just sit back there and allow the defense counsel to bring this up and say, what you didn't hear. And we wanted to own the fact that, yes, there is this looming motive out there regarding money, and as the defense counsel said, this case is all about money. And so we wanted the opportunity to address it, especially in light of that of pretrial litigation, the defense counsel's statements just before opening statements, as well as the marked exhibits. I think it was fair for the state to at least address at least part of the civil suit in order to combat that defense. And then I wanted to make one more mention. I know, Justice Stiglitz, you mentioned this about 51385.
Yeah, I have some questions about this. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. And first of all, I just want to correct the record a little bit. And when we're talking about the officer, this is Officer Sink. He was an Arizona police officer. The state withdrew its 51385 notice regarding Officer Sink. In fact, the defense counsel said, no, I want to use Officer Sink. And so we did do the 51385 based upon what defense counsel wanted. The state was happy to just to proceed to trial just with Amanda Halper, who was the principal of the day, and not have Officer Singh testify. But in fact, at a break, both defense counsel as well as the state spoke to Officer Singh, and based upon that conversation, defense counsel put on the record that he did in fact want Officer Singh to testify. So it wasn't the state who...
But the state called him.
We did, out of courtesy...
I don't understand that. You didn't want it, but you called him anyway. Why don't you let the defense call him?
It was early on in our case. It was a three-week trial, and he had flown in from Arizona. And
so what? It's a criminal case. We're talking about somebody going to prison for the rest of their life. So tell me about why the state would go ahead and call a witness that they didn't want to testify.
Well, it's not that we didn't want to testify. We just thought we had enough. But it was the defense counsel who said, look, I want certain information coming out. And so it was his strategic move to say, state, I don't mind if you call Officer Singh. And based upon those representations that are in the appellate appendix, that are in trial transcripts, that's why we put Officer Singh up. Now, as far as spontaneous...
Wait, before we get before, when the defense indicated they wanted to call him, did they want to call him for purposes other than the same statements that you wanted? You understand what I'm saying? Like, why did they want to call him versus what you ended up putting in? If you know.
I wish I was.
Well, because did they object at that time to under 385? And so when they said, hey, we want you to call him, and you said, we're going to call him, did they say, hey, we object that he can testify to X, but he can't testify to Y?
No, he did not. There was no objection as far as limiting Officer Singh's testimony. And if you, courts, just brief indulgence, so I'll take a look.
Well, his testimony was limited. Correct?
Excuse me?
Wasn't his testimony limited? He wasn't able to say that he came there because there was an allegation that the mother was beating the child?
That is true. Now, I wanted
to... But you can't say something's limited when it isn't limited.
Well, in this sense... Okay.
Or I should say it is limited.
It is limited.
It is limited, not limited.
The way that the testimony came out from Officer Singh, I would actually suggest that it actually harmed the state versus the defense. And this is the reason why. There was testimony that Zaylee always got in trouble. And that, as Mr. Oren just said here, that she would lie and that she would steal. So the fact that she's being called to the principal's office makes it to lends it an inference, or I believe a reasonable inference, that this child was in trouble for something. Because based upon the cross-examination of ZF, ZF keeps getting in trouble. She's kind of out of control, she's lying a lot, she has problems with some stealing, with markers and things of that sort. And so that's why she was called to the principal's office. I think there's absolutely a reasonable inference for the jury to believe that's the particular case based upon the state of the evidence.
But it's not true. She was called to the principal's office because she alleged that her mother beat her.
Correct.
So why can't the defense have the inference that that's why she switched and said that Thomas molested her?
Because I don't think there's any probative value, because the theory of defense there is, again, to deflect away from her mother beating her and to somehow thwart the CPS investigation or police investigation. And what was shown to the trial court was Zia did anything but deflect from the physical abuse of her mother. In fact, she went above and beyond by pointing out other injuries to her body that couldn't be seen by the staff. And actually, she had to remove clothing to even show that there was other cord marks, or that there were even other instances of whipping, and even other instances of where she's being slapped around. I think that absolutely goes against the defense that this is somehow deflecting. I think it's belied by what the trial court relied upon, which was in the state's moving papers as well as the reply regarding this motion to preclude.
So Ms. Renetti, on
yes.
Spontaneity, and I don't want to cut you off, but
yes.
Okay. Under 385, if the witness testifies, doesn't testify, unavailable. So the concern I'm having with introducing police testimony in this fashion through 385 is if the witness had not testified, or the victim had not testified, would that even pass constitutional muster under Crawford? Like, is there a tension here between this, I know that spontaneity is one factor, But it's a pretty significant factor as it goes to trustworthiness, too. I mean, that's kind of inherent in that. So I just want to get your thoughts on that.
And I'm happy to address that. And I believe, obviously, that doesn't necessarily apply in this case in the sense of...
Well, testified. Like, get it.
Uh-huh. Having done these type of cases for the last... Having the honor of doing these cases for the last 6.5 years, a lot of times, the person abusing the child is the person that this child relies upon most. A parent, someone in the home, a caregiver. And oftentimes, it's the child reaching out. Because who do they have contact with? Sometimes it's police, sometimes it's medical. It's whoever comes to their house, especially in the sense of our first responders. A lot of times with children, you know, the majority of children that are abused are under the age of 4. And with that, that means their contact to the limit is limited to the outside world. They don't go to school, so they don't have teachers and principals and counselors. Kind of like in this case, some of school parents notices a mark on ZF's arm and contacts school, and the school gets involved. And especially in children, young children, a lot of times their lifeline is kind of, there is no lifeline, because those who are responsible for their care are the abusers. So I think, it's hard to say that there should be like some type of bright line rule when it comes to police officers, especially in light of children, that somehow children know that whatever I'm going to say to the police, somehow there's going to be court proceedings down the way. And I think that's a fundamental distinction, for, especially when we're talking about children, especially 51385 is under the age of 10. And I think that it's a good distinction as far as what an adult would think when contacting police versus a child under the age of 10 who's reaching out for assistance and help in an abusive environment.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I will...
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate learning what exactly happened to ZF, other than right now I didn't know. And I asked trial counsel, did you know any of that that happened to ZF? We didn't know that. That was sealed. I couldn't get a hold of it. But I'm interested, and it was curious to know that she was beaten all over her body, and this is what she said. It was very interesting, and it most certainly could have been used very, very advantageously by defense counsel at trial. It could have been. There are numerous, numerous problems with what the prosecution has told the court. I want to talk about the civil lawsuit. Right? So we'll go through this very carefully. I am going to be reviewing pages 51 and 52 of my opening brief. Before defense counsel started, before opening argument, defense counsel said he admitted his desire to question witnesses on their bias of filing a civil lawsuit, but did not intend to discuss any financial settlement. There's a cite to that. Then the judge says, I guess my answer is, if he opens the door, then the order will get in once he opens the door. If he doesn't open the door, dash, however you want to handle it. Opening argument. Here's what is said by the prosecutor. And I will tell you that the civil suit has settled and they did receive money and it is locked in an account. The children and their families do not have access to the money until the children are 18. You will hear what those parents are intending to do with the money. It is their children's money. The prosecutor today told you that the defense brought out the money. Well, I cited on page 52 where April Reed is being questioned. Do you know how much money is in the blocked account? Answer, it's about $31,000. Then, in closing argument, prosecutor said, it's $32,000. Is that enough to have your child touched? And so I continuously cite that when also Ms. Cheryl Barbin was questioned and she said her child received $50,000. And I put cites showing that defense counsel had not even mentioned the lawsuit at that time. So they brought it out. And they brought out the numbers. They brought out the lawsuit. There is no case law to support this. This wasn't, we're being told now defense wanted to do this. Defense wanted to do this.
But under a plain error review, where the defense is in part financial motive to fabricate.
Yes, right? Yes.
How do we review that on plain error?
Because it's clear from the record. There's no, he said he wasn't going to do it. And the court said, we'll deal with that if he opens the door. So isn't that the ruling? I mean, if we're sitting there as lawyers, I would think the judge is going to make a ruling if I open the door, not just let the prosecution just get up and say it all. And so that's plain error. It seems very obvious to me.
But in the grand scheme, because now the trial's over, there was not an objection. In the grand scheme, where the defense is financial motive.
Yes.
And the prosecutor, whether you decide that's error or not, has brought it in before you did. How did that affect the outcome of the trial?
Because it goes to show the jury that it's probably already been settled. People wiser than us may have already decided this. Maybe a judge decided that. Maybe another jury decided that. And that's what those cases that I cited talk about. It looks like to an average juror that this is already being decided. Why is somebody paying out, I don't have the numbers in my mind, like $110,000 unless somebody's guilty. And that's the problem with it. I have other matters that I think, I really hope the court will look at all the errors combined in this case. Well, and a few other things. When the defendant was canvassed about his testimony, he was told about felony convictions. The state then said, well, we're not saying, we may bring up some bad acts. And trial counsel said, well, I'm not on notice of these. The exact quote of the prosecution is, impeachment, don't need to. Then when the defendant got up, they started asking these very strange statements about SK. Did you go up in the attic with SK? This is an uncharged person. Yeah. Was there an unresolved issue? No, it wasn't unresolved. You were terminated. I was suspended or I was off. They just brought it out. Under Tinge, how can they just say something like it's impeachment? Don't need to. What's the law? I don't understand the law.
Don't need to canvass on it?
No.
Or don't need to? I'm not understanding what you're saying right now.
Okay. The defendant's canvassed about if he has felony convictions. The prosecution then says, oh, by the way, we may bring out bad acts if he testifies. Defense counsel says, I'm not aware of these bad acts. What bad acts? Could I have notice? The prosecutor's response, impeachment. Don't need it. I don't need to tell you. So nobody knew. So when the defendant's on the stand, now he's being questioned about SK, some other person. It made him look so bad. And how is that worse? When the defendant's wife testified, she was then questioned about whether he had used corporal punishment on his own child. And she said, well, she didn't say spank, but she said, we have done hands-on. Oh, well, he wouldn't hurt a child. It's completely improper. And then in closing argument, the prosecutor argued, you don't believe these kids? What do you need, a fifth victim, a sixth victim? Absolutely, the jury thought, that's SK. That's what she's referring to. That's why she questioned the defense attorney or the defendant about it. It's so blatantly unfair under the bad acts motion. I want to also complain about something else. The defense asked to have an independent psych of these children. It was denied. The reason I say this is because I thought that this was so just completely grossly unfair and a good representation of the case. When Mr. Donahue, the expert, got on the stand, he wasn't allowed to talk to the children. All of a sudden, he's questioned, how much have you been paid? What's your, I think, $350 an hour, something like that. Next question, did you talk to ZF? No. Did you talk to AP? No. Objection. Approach. Judge, you denied... The prior judge denied the motion to have my expert interview the kids. Oh, this is proper cross-examination. Proper cross-examination? The poor doctor's up there. He looks like an idiot. He's asked, like, you didn't even bother to talk to these people because right after the bench conference, they went back and then went through all four of the alleged victims. Did you talk to this person? Did you talk to that person?
And then on redirect, did you address that point?
The defense counsel.
I keep saying you.
No,
you
because he wasn't. He was precluded from doing so. He was precluded.
Once the judge allowed that type of examination, there should have been an additional request. Judge, based upon this, we need to go there.
The objection was made at the bench, and the judge said it's proper cross-examination. He can't do more than that. I mean, at that point.
Oh, I think you can make a record. Judge, I need to approach.
And make a record set and telling the judge, well, okay, here's the problem that I see with that. How does the judge make that ruling? How does the judge make the ruling at the bench? If I've precluded defense counsel from bringing up or talking to having his expert talk to the children.
Wait, can't you ask your expert, why didn't you talk to the children? And the expert says, I wasn't allowed to. I mean, why don't you just ask the expert, why did you want to talk to the kids? Yes, why didn't you? I was told I couldn't. I mean, I don't understand that.
I agree. When I remember distinctly the moment when I read that. And I remember thinking, if I was the expert, I'd say, I wasn't allowed to. Mm-hmm. But I think that expert was terrified to say that. And isn't the problem with the court's ruling? But again, is that going to overturn the case? I don't think so. But the point that I'm trying to make is how unfair all of these rulings were. They were so unfair to the defendant. You're letting the defendant's wife be questioned about corporal punishment out of the blue? What happened to Tinch? What happened to the bad acts requirements? Is that something I can say? Is that court going to do something to me if I do this in one of my trials? Impeachment. Don't need to. Because I know what? If this trial happened again, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't. But I want to do it. I want to say, are you going to bring out anything about April and the beating? I'm not going to talk about it. It's impeachment. Don't need to. Okay. And that's the kind of cavalier attitude that shouldn't have taken place in any trial. I do realize, I respect the prosecutors in this case very much. I respect the two prosecutors very much. I think in the heat of battle, sometimes a judge has to rein litigants in. I think that it's our nature, fine prosecutors like this, to really go hard. But this needed to be reined in. It needed to be stopped. And in the last 18 seconds that I have, how does the prosecutor say, in closing arguments, everything's fine, there are no problems, what would be the motives to do this? The defendant had to want to scream out, she's deflecting, she's being beaten. That's why. Maybe the court wouldn't agree, but it's something we should have been able to argue. With that, I'd submit it. Thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks Ms. Renetti and Mr. Warren for your fine, fine oral arguments and your preparation in this matter. Both of you are excellent, excellent fellow attorneys. I congratulate both of you. This matter will stand submitted, and I think we're